So today we're going to talk about your valuable money, and we're going to do it by way of talking of two tribes, Yisachar and Zevulun. Yisachar and Zevulun had a pact between them in which Yisachar, the tribe of Yisachar, they would study Torah all day long. So how did they survive? Because Zevulun, they were into importing and exporting goods through ships, etc. And they would support those in the tribe of Yisachar with the stipulation that the reward of Yisachar go to the tribe of Zevulun. Now we're in the narrative of where the tribes are being born. We did the first four. We're now going to do another two. And this kind of an agreement begs the question, is it so easy to become spiritual? How could I do something that's that easy myself? You might say, well, that's not so easy because you have to actually sweat a little bit to earn some money. And we're going to get into all of that because this really is a foundation of Yiddishkeit. It's a foundation of how you look at life. It's definitely a foundation of how you look at your work or whatever is involved to earn money. So therefore, let's talk about how valuable is your money. So let's talk about what is value. Is value only in the eyes of the beholder? A certain well-known, wealthy individual, I forgot his name, he bought a huge painting, which I believe is all black with one red square in the middle. And because it was after the death of that particular painter, a contemporary painter, it was only priced at $80 million. So you might say value is in the eyes of the beholder. What I would like to share with you today about value is that there is, in fact, intrinsic value. Intrinsic value, the way I'm going to define it, means it's not only intrinsic, it's value to the item itself, but that this value is real. It's non-disputable, which means it's not in the eye of the beholder. And needless to say, the facade type value is only in the eyes of the beholder. So to explain this, I would like to take what may appear as a bit of a diversion and talk about ownership. What is ownership? Because money relates to ownership, as we're going to see. So let's take the narrative of this world and how ownership came into being. The Almighty created the world and the first man and woman. So now, ownership, which means the right to control, ownership, the right to control, was in their hands. But the fact that they have the right to control doesn't mean that they were actively controlling. But the moment they started taking active control on anything, those items were within their control, obviously, and we call that ownership. Those things that they had no reason, or they just didn't get involved in controlling, that's called ownerless. So they had children, and who gets the right to control what is ownerless? Whoever gets it first. And that holds true till today. If somebody throws something into the garbage, that is an action in which they declare it ownerless without giving a speech or not. They want to have no more control over it. They're just hoping the city just hauls it away. Or they can toss it out of their window of a car, let's say, and throw out garbage if they do that. Anybody who picks it up, now you have the right of control. So the first people of the world, they went and they took control. But now I'd like to paint an image as follows. If you ever go to a farm or any place where there are animals together, you're going to see something like this. And you're going to see why there is no ownership in the animal kingdom. So you have two calves, and one has grown a bit bigger than the other. And the farmer brings two buckets of hay. Each animal puts its head right into the bucket, and it starts eating. Now, needless to say, the bigger one is going to be finishing its food first. So what does it do? It takes its body and shoves the smaller one away. So obviously the head is out of the bucket, and then it's put its head right into the bucket, and it takes whatever it wants to take. What about ownership? There is no ownership. Just because your head is in the bucket doesn't mean that I don't take it. And that's how the animal kingdom works. In other words, ownership, I'm going to say in English, is a contract between civilized people. Obviously, those who are not civilized, so they're more animalistic. So they push you out of the way and they take what is yours. Now, at some point, let's just see how far this goes. At some point, this social contract goes to the degree that something that is taken by force eventually belongs to the one who took it by force. Where do you see that? Every single occupied piece of land on this planet, which nowadays includes every square inch of dry land, has been taken by force. Every country you go to, without exception, there was a war. I'll say at least one, but usually over the ages, there were many, many wars. And whoever was stronger and beat out the others for right of control, they took it as their own. You may remember a war in the Falkland Islands. So this has nothing to do with whom one thinks is right or wrong. I don't really know or have any interest into what the issues behind it was. But along came from the other side of the world some British people in a ship, and they said, no, we're not going to let you take control, and we're going to blow you out of the way. And that's what they did. So whether we like it or not, we are sitting right now, wherever you are, you're sitting on a piece of real estate that was taken through brute force. So whether it's good or bad is irrelevant. What I'm pointing out here is that what is the land value of the real estate you're on? So that ownership, that value isn't real. It's actually theoretical. It's just that human beings, as long as they want to be in the realm of being civilized, they agree to that contract. So therefore, you want to take a piece of land and do whatever you want in it. You do that because the big daddy who has a bigger power than you, that's the government of your country, who has the strong arm of the army on their side, they give you permission. So therefore, you have this right of ownership. So therefore, when we talk about your valuable money, I am not talking about value that's theoretical either. And furthermore, it used to be that even the currency on, I don't know about dollars, how it worked on this side of the ocean, but I certainly know that British pounds, the currency used to be corresponding to gold. In fact, unless they have changed it in recent times, but as long as I lived in England, the British pound has a statement on it as follows. I promise to pay the bearer of this document or this bill the amount of £1. So in other words, the British pound was printed as a promissory note. So you might say that even money, it corresponds to gold, but who owns the gold? The gold came from the ground or from wherever, some waterway that they took it from. So the value of money, even if you want to say it corresponds to gold, even that money is like any other physical item. So what is its real value? Just as theoretical as any other ownership. Because one bird comes along, swoops down to another's nest, and takes the eggs, or another animal that likes eggs. Today's money, it's the value is even less so. Because at the end of the day, today's money is just about digits, basically switches off and on in computers. So in theory, I don't know if it will ever come to fruition, but in theory, the world might even run only on theoretical money, meaning to say money that is digits. In other words, there's no substance to it. So when I correctly called this class your valuable money, it really makes no difference how much of it you have in the bank or in your pocket. We are going to explore what is the real value of your money that is not just intrinsic as it's normally understood, but it is real, 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 real value. And it makes no difference if your money is a gold crown. A crown is a coin that used to be used on the other side of the pond. Or your money is just what they call a Bitcoin, which is just, it's a theoretical. There's nothing, it's just digits. I know the Bitcoin is a particular thing, but the Bitcoin is the, I guess, the ultimate because it never started with any substance. But be that as it may. So let's take a look at what is intrinsic value and that is real. And I should have said something at the beginning of this class which is that this class may be shorter than usual. See, I had a decision to make. I could have spoken about two tribes, Yisachar and Zevulun, and because of what I was going to say is what you're going to hear today, and then moved on to other tribes. There is one tribe, Yosef, which is, there's so much to say about it. There's another tribe, Don. But I figured that because this is so central to the life of anyone who lives in the world, because everything moves in the world through money. In fact, those who say love makes the world go around, I say, actually, the exchange of money makes the world go around, and love keeps the world populated, and love drives people mad also. So I figured it's so central to an insight for living, I decided that even if this class finishes early, I'm not going to include any of the other tribes. So let's proceed. Let's continue with where we just left off. So let's talk about real value. And the real value is also the value that counts before God. But even if a person says, well, what if I don't believe in God? Is there still value? Well, there is, because the value is a reality. And this is what we're going to explain now. In Judaism, there are two components to reality. One is mental, emotional, and physical effort, which is involved in anything that we do. There's even effort of some measurable kind to blinking your eyes, all the way to anything that is the most strenuous. And the second fact of reality that has value is the result. And I'd like to depict this foundation of what we're going to explain as follows. There's a story in the Talmud. A wealthy man decided he was going to bring an offering before God. And why would he do that? Because the word korban, this is an important side point, does not translate into sacrifice. The word korban translates into a means of getting close. Now, there is no such word in the English language, and I've looked high and low. If somebody knows of such a word that really says it clearly, I'd love to hear it. But korban means a means of getting close. And that's why the korban doesn't have to be always an animal. It can be even flour, oil, and other such things. So this person, he was wealthy, and he decided that he is going to bring a big animal, a big cow, for an offering. Now, as he's bringing it to the temple, this big cow decides it wants to stop moving. So what do you do when a cow doesn't want to move? I actually don't know. But whatever farmers do to get a cow to move, to prod it, to this, to that, nothing helped. And there was another fellow, who a very poor fellow, and he had some vegetables with him to eat. Maybe it was carrots, I do not remember. Whatever, vegetables, whatever it was. And he saw what was going on. Now, there is a very serious issue when you dedicate an animal to bring it as a korban, that you cannot use it for other things. So what did he do? He took his food and he put it in front of the mouth of this cow. And that's how he coaxed it into moving forward, until it was far enough and they could take care of the cow and bring this offering on behalf of the wealthy man. That night, the wealthy man has a dream, saying that the korban, the means of getting close that was offered by this poor man, is greater than this choice cow of yours, as big and as expensive as it was. Why? Because its value, this is the word, its value was that from what he is able to have for himself, he gave so much of it away, to the point that he was left without food to eat. Whereas for you, what effort was there in dispensing of your what you own in order to bring this korban? So what we're seeing here is that the effort, and when I say effort, I don't just mean in the involvement of trying. I mean, when a person just decides and they think about something and they're wrestling with the mental side of it, the emotional side of it, and then obviously there's action steps to take All of those things are realities without which the result would not occur. And that's why it is real. You can have everything, but if you didn't plan it correctly, you're going to miss what you're trying to do, and it's not going to happen. So all of this is reality, and it has nothing to do with value in the eyes of the beholder. It doesn't have to do with a social contract. It has to do with absolute reality of this world. And it's not just that your thinking and your emotions and the ability to move are things that are given to you by the Almighty. It happens to be that those are things that's the stuff of this world, of this physical world, is the thoughts and the emotions and the actions that are involved. So that's one part of it. But now let's take a look at another reality, which is the result. You see, in the case of the story that I just mentioned, there were two results. One was the fact that the poor man gave away his food. And the other was that the wealthy man gave his cow for that purpose. So there was both in that story. But now let's take a situation where you have two of these, where, I'm sorry, only one of these. So we live in the world of plenty, and it comes Pesach. We just passed by Passover. So matzah, we got matzah, and we had matzah. So who fulfilled the actual mitzvah of eating matzah on the first night of Pesach? All of those thousands, millions of Jewish people who ate matzah. Now, what were they thinking of when they ate matzah? Actually, it doesn't matter. The mitzvah is to actually eat it. So if they ate it, they have the mitzvah. Very simple. And now let's think of something else. And just to make this reality, I knew of a certain individual. I've told a certain story about him many times. His name is Reb Mendel Futterfass. And he told this story about himself when he was in the Gulag for 10 years. One year, a package of matzahs did come to him for Pesach. Now, you have to understand that sending matzahs to the Gulag, you couldn't just send it, because many times it arrived and they said, no, nothing arrived. And they told the sender, sorry, but your whatever next of kin is dead. I mean, countless situations like that. But this Reb Mendel Futterfass, he got 6 matzahs, if I remember correctly how much he got. He decided that he's going to keep 3 for next year, because who knows what he's going to do. Now, they, of course, had to keep the Jewish calendar in their mind. So it just goes to tell you, what do you do with 3 matzahs for a whole year? There's no place to hide, because you're in the Gulag with a bunch of ruffians, Cossacks, all sorts of interesting people, and they would like some extra food. So it doesn't matter what you do. They're going to steal it. They're going to eat it. For an entire year, he carried those 3 matzahs around for the next Pesach. And when he told that story in the yeshiva in Kfar Chabad, he was asked by one of the boys at the table, Bochrim, isn't that difficult to hold 3 matzahs for a whole year? He said, no. If it's anything that's precious to you, it's not difficult to hold. And just think about that for a second. If you have actual gold coins like we have here, like real gold, I don't know if you know the price of an ounce of gold. I don't, but I do know that it's way over $1,000. And that's not much, 1 ounce. What would you do? You just leave it around? No. How difficult is it to hold on to it? It's actually delicious to hold on to it. Now, let's say that the day before Pesach, just to dramatize the story, the day before Pesach, he slips and the matzahs fall out of his hands. And let's say those Cossacks grab the matzah and they eat it on the spot. Comes to Pesach, he has no matzah. Now, many people in the Gulag, many Jews in the Gulag, there were years they did not have matzah. So would he have fulfilled the commandment of eating matzah? And the answer is no, because there's two parts of reality. There is the real effort we put into something that's real, and that he had in a way that none of us in the free world would ever have it. But he did not have the matzah go down into his throat and be swallowed. He did not have that. So that is, when we talk about real value from God's point of view, it's what's the reality that you had to work hard to make something happen, and then what was the result? So if somebody is giving tzedakah, just as an example, the Rambam writes that there are 8 levels to tzedakah. And they have to do with how comfortable you make sure the recipient is when you are giving tzedakah. But the assumption in each case is that the recipient receives exactly the same thing. So what we're seeing here is that how you give it, and so that it can be received in a certain way, is super important. But what if you're so involved in refining your character that you should be in a good mood before you give it, and now the recipient is going without? That doesn't make any sense. These are two separate things. So these are two realities of value. And now what I would like to ask you, I'd like to talk to you about everything that we use in this world, whether it's food or cars. What is their true value? And realize that money, whether money is a digital number in cyberspace somewhere, or it's a weight of gold, it's merely a means of exchanging that product and that effort, which I'm going to now call service, meaning doing, and whether the steward or stewardess is nice to you, etc., all of those things, I'll call it service. Those are two realities. What is the real value? So money is just a way of transferring a product, the value of a product and the value of a service. That's all money is, which is the reason why it's possible to go from gold to a digit in cyberspace. And in order to do that, I'm going to share the screen. Is a sec. And here it is. Okay, let's take a look at what is involved in anything that we receive. Anything. It could be food. And what I'd like to show you is that when you give money, you are giving the piece of paper or the digit in cyberspace that does, in fact, take the effort of people, intellectual, mental, emotional, physical effort, and passes it on to someone else. In other words, it's the veritable life energy of every person involved. Let's remember how we started. How could it be so simple that the tribe of Yisachar will study all day long Torah and not have work for a living? And they can do that because the tribe of Zebulun, who are big business people, imports and exports, they pay them, they split it in half. So they get half the reward and they pay for the livelihood of the tribe of Yisachar. How does that work? Is that not an easy way out? And now we're beginning to see real value. And now you're going to see something about value that maybe you're aware of intellectually, but the enormity of it, I don't know that we necessarily think about it. Let's take raw material. Now, the raw material has to be taken to the supplier. Now, we're going to talk about what is involved in creating raw material or uncovering raw material, any raw material, not just food, not just anything that's in the ground, precious metals, oil, you name it. What is involved in manufacturing and distribution? What's involved in the distribution around the entire world? All of these are realities. These are not social contracts, and they're just real. And eventually, the distribution from all over the world makes its way to the retailer. Now, from the retailer, obviously, it makes its way to the shopper. From the shopper, it makes its way into that person's ability to stay alive, whether it is by eating, which is easy to understand, or whether it is by having shelter, that they're in a home that doesn't leak, and that they can warm up, and that they have electricity and lights. So we're talking about real value as it makes its way. So now let's break that down a little bit more. And this is kind of an image that if you just look at it without zeroing in onto something, it's enough to give you a headache. Starting off with this spinning thing, I don't know who NX Auto is. It really doesn't matter. But the point is just what's involved in the production of automobiles. So let's just take a look here at the bottom left. You have the doors, you have the body, whatever they're trying to say about it. Let's just understand something. Where does the raw material for these doors come? where's this sand that is involved in making the glass of these windows coming from? And how does it get to the plant? And then, whoops, let me just move this out of the way so we can see what it says. Where does this paint? What about the rubber that's involved? And there happens to be a history behind the rubber. And I'll just pick on that because you might know it. Originally, rubber was discovered as a certain sap that was taken from trees. And by some so-called accident, as many discoveries occurred by so-called accident, rubber was discovered. Now, they decided years later that instead of fighting for territories, which is what happened in order to be able to monopolize the production of rubber, that they decided they can make synthetic rubber, which is what we use today. So in other words, I'm picking on rubber because there's a whole story of realities that led up to the production of rubber, which accounts for anything that was transported using rubber, not just rubber tires, but any rubber on a ship that keeps out the water, and on it goes. So the truth is, we could go through this whole situation here, and it's not necessary because it's even more than we understand. Let's just turn to, actually, before we get to this one, let's just focus our attention for a moment on this computer here. So the production of the computer is, you can say, like any other production. But what about, what is involved in what travels at the speed of light is those messages through the internet. Now, I once saw a clip, which I didn't find before the class, in which it showed how in every local area, there's a place where all those signals go to. There are places, I'm sorry, where all those signals go to. And from there, it goes to some other unit or something. And then it goes to the satellite. And from the satellite, it goes down to all those other places. And just like we have power stations for electricity, there are stations that are transporting the signal. And just think of what's involved in the creation of all of those. And if you just want your mind to go wild for a little bit, just think of what was involved physically in terms of product and in terms of human effort, the way I broke it down already many times, into arriving at a satellite in space. Let's move here. The building of a house. So this is also very simple, but you could see it. There are sawmills, there are lumber yards, there's building materials, there are factories, there are furniture store, furniture, and so on. Paper. And I'll say something like this because we don't even think about it. Paper, a paper mill, you'll excuse me, it produces toilet paper, which is the way we can actually use modern day plumbing instead of using an outhouse. On and on and on. What is involved in generating electricity? So here, not here. So in this case, and we have a lot of hydraulic power in this part of the world, BC Hydro, right? We have cheaper electricity than in the States. We actually export electricity to the United States. So every facet just of this part, look what's involved in the running water. Where does the running water come from? From the melting ice. And what causes the ice to melt? The change in temperature. And what causes that? The very sun itself. So now, the melted water has traveled down the mountainsides, down the forests, rivers, all sorts of situations, and eventually it comes through here. Along comes humans, and they build this dam, and they build this generator, which is involved in all of those other things. They let it out to the river, and as this spins around, they have power generated, and they pass it on, and every inch of the way, there's human intervention involved. And then there are other ways to generate electricity. One of the most efficient ways, at least this is what I'm given to understand, is actually nuclear power plants. So just think of what scientific discovery and research was involved to arrive at nuclear fission, I believe is the word, to have nuclear power plants. And then on and on it goes, all the way till we have electricity so that we can have light in our home through those light bulbs. How did they come around? So we could go on forever and ever. And here is what our sages have to say on the subject about real value. They say that when you, and this is before the world was as complicated as it is today, But food was much easier. You grew something in your field, and you took a sickle, and who knows, maybe wherever the sickle was made, and so on and so forth. And you have harvested your crops. You took some for seeds for next year, and you use this and this mechanism to grind it into flour. Or maybe there was a windmill in certain locations or watermill in other locations. But they make this point. When a person acknowledges before eating food that veritably God's energy, God's light, godliness was involved all over the world for this spoonful of food to make its way, as it's going to make its way, into my mouth, to give me energy. So all of those elements are giving me energy to do what? To make choices between right from wrong. So in other words, what's being elevated here? From all over the world. If you would like to see this in stark reality, if you were ever given the job of doing kosher supervision in a plant that produces food, Quaker or any company like that, any aisle, when I say it an aisle, I mean it's a long aisle, not just like the long aisles in Superstore that seems to have the longest aisles, much longer than that. And you just see the raw products in the sacks, in the drums, and in the cases, every continent almost, maybe, I don't know about the Antarctica and the Arctic, but every other place, in every other continent is represented. The amount of countries, it's just unbelievable what is represented there, especially with the complicated food we have. One of the places that you'll have it most is like in colored sprinkles that kids love to have on their ice cream. There's hundreds. We had a presentation here several years ago by somebody from Kosheris. There's over 300 ingredients in those little things. And if you want to see that for your own eyes, next time you go to the supermarket, look at the ingredients of any bottled salad dressing. And they only have to list those things that are 2% or more. On average, you'll find over 50 ingredients on those bottles. And each ingredient, the way things work today, they come from all over the world. So when a person, for example, makes a blessing on food, you thank God for the food. What you are acknowledging is the real value of that food. How every part of the world, millions, actually billions of people, have involvement in some form in this that you're acknowledging by saying a blessing before and after food. But we're talking about money. How do you get your money? Maybe you bought a lottery ticket and you won the lottery. Even though this still applies to those people, it doesn't apply to the rest of us. Most people actually have to put in effort to earn money. When they put in their effort, where does the ability to use that effort come from? It comes from the fact that they have food, that they have clothing, and they have shelter. Because if they did not have food and they were not able to regulate the temperature of their bodies and keep out the wild elements of weather, they couldn't live. And in order to do all those things came from somewhere. All those things came from raw materials. It goes through the whole Megillah. That means protracted step-by-step narrative that I just said. Everything is involved in our, what I'm going to call, you know, sweat equity, emotional equity, mental energy. All of those things are involved. That's the real value of those digits that come up on your bank account that only exist in cyberspace. That's their true value. In other words, what was physically involved in it coming to your ability to use and to internalize if you're using it as food. So now, anytime we talk about using money for something, you're not just harnessing value, that's perceived value, that's external value. You're actually harnessing undisputable real value. And what are you harnessing it towards? So let's use an example of Yisachar and Zevulun, the two tribes. This is where we started from. The tribe of Yisachar, they're going to sit there in Israel all day long, not go to work, and they're going to study all day. The tribe of Zevulun, they're going to put a lot of equity into earning a living. Imports and exports was much more risky business than it is today, even though there exists such a thing as pirates today. But in those days, they, not only did they have pirates, excuse me, the possibility of being lost at sea was very real. Just to make it personal, the Rambam used to be able to study all day long because he had a brother named David, who, that's what he did. He did imports and exports, and then he got lost at sea. And that's when the Rambam had to earn a living. And that's when he studied to become a doctor. And he actually describes how hard he used to work. So the Rambam, he had no time. This is not a class about the Rambam, but talking about real value of imports and exports, that was the exchange. So is it something that's so easy, just throw money at something? You're not just throwing money. Let's take not somebody who, well, it could be somebody who won the lottery, but the overwhelming majority of those people actually lose it within 5 years, apparently. That's what they say. But let's talk about somebody who inherited a flourishing business. So really, they go to work. They don't have to. Whoever left them enough that their great-grandchildren should be able to own their own mansion each, you know, all of that. Nevertheless, there's still value in that money. Do you know how many people work in those, whatever the industry happens to be? We're coming back to the very same thing. Just because it's easy for a certain person to give money, there's nothing wrong with it. The fact that it's easy for us to get a hold of matzah and just eat it, Pesach night, that's all we got to do. Does that mean it's tainted? Of course not. If it involves effort, yes, then it has more value because more of the reality is invested in it. So this is how that deal works. Studying Torah involves a lot of things. It involves being able to live, having energy to study Torah using your mind, and having the ability to support them involves being successful business people. So that's how they made that exchange. In fact, the Gemara tells us that a Jewish city is not considered a significant city until it has such a group of 10 people who spend their entire day studying Torah and are supported by the Jewish people. That is what is normally meant around the world with the term kolel. Now, kolel means all-encompassing, but the word kolel, if people say, I'm going to the kolel, what they normally mean is that I'm going to this place where people study all day and they get supported by the community. Because this concept needs to be ever present in people's minds. Where are you going to expend your value? Where are you going to expend your true value? So now let's bring this to ourselves. Let's say you have X amount of dollars, anywhere between $1 billion with a B, or you have 1 cent, anywhere in between. The value of your money isn't changed just because there's 100 cents to each dollar and there's $1 billion to your so-called net worth. The value of money does not change. But when you take that cent or that $1 billion or a part of it or whatever it is, and you use it to enable something that is happening, such as right now, because right now, we have 14 units of people, which in some cases is more than one. When you have 14 units of people, however many people it is, whatever the real number is, when you have that many units of people who are engaging in Torah study, so now those who give of their own energy to support it, which very usually translates through the transference of funds, but not only, in any which way, what you're really doing, what we are really doing, what anyone is really doing, is utilizing the real value of money. So your valuable money is what we are speaking about. And therefore, anytime it comes to thinking, to supporting that which is precious to the Almighty, you, instead of taking the value of your money and leaving it where it currently is, in its position where it is, because you cannot negate the fact that such and such effort from millions of people the world over, as we just explained, went into it, but it does not become elevated. But then when you take 1 cent and you put it towards the fulfillment of God's plan, you have now taken every single element involved in that money, and it's elevated. Why is it elevated? Because now what's the value of that person who begrudgingly dragged himself to work and bolted out as soon as his shift was finished, and he just did it because he has to pay his rent or whatever. Whatever that looks like, it really doesn't matter. That the value of what was involved there was elevated towards God's purpose. So that is really your valuable money. And this comes to us through the two tribes of Yisachar and Zebulun and the pact that was made between them, which is first mentioned in the last Torah portion of the entire Torah, Vezot HaBracha, where it says, Samach Zebulun B'tzeisecho. First it says, Zebulun, you should be happy when you go out, meaning when you go out to the world through your ships. They lived by the Mediterranean Sea, that tribe. And you go through your ships to involve yourself in imports and exports. Samach Zebulun B'tzeisecho, you should be happy with your involvement with the mundane. V'Yisachar, and secondly, and as a result, the tribe of Yisachar, Bo'ehalecho, in your tents, meaning in the tents of study, what we call in English the houses of study. Every one of you now, whether you will win the lottery, or you did win the lottery, or you never will win the lottery, or wherever you want to place yourself according to Revenue Canada, it's irrelevant. Every one of you now understands your valuable money, and the only thing that's left that is a veritable insight for living, that is a foundation of Yiddishkeit, is decide where you're going to direct your valuable money. Thank you very much for joining. It is a little early, but as I said before, this is important enough that I do not want to dilute the message of today's class by speaking about any of the other tribes. So if you would like, you may now unmute. And if you have any comments, by all means. Thank you very much for joining.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Oh, and one more thing, I'm sorry. Believe me, this was not choreographed by me, although it was choreographed by the Almighty, and I didn't know it, and Esther didn't know it, that this would be the subject of a class that is sponsored in memory of Shmuel Shmaya ben Shlomo, whose yahrzeit is tonight. So there we go. The Almighty knows what he's doing. Yes, thank you. Thank you all.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So Issachar studied Torah all day. What did Zebulun get in return from Issachar? What was the...
They got half of the merit of their Torah study is what Issachar received. So in other words, let's just be practical for a second. Anyone who donated towards the matzah that we distributed, that hundreds of people ate on especially the first night of Pesach, that's your valuable money, right? It's just being very real.
Okay. You know, Rabbi, there's an economic law that dictates and mandates the value of anything, be it matzah that's wrapped up in a shmata, the value of a diamond, the value of jewelry, and that's the law of supply and demand. When you are in a prison or a concentration camp, and you have a tiny little bit of matzah with no hope of having any more matzah than that, that is extremely valuable because the supply is extremely low. It applies to almost everything.
That's right. That's right. So it's, in other words, you see, there's something else that I wanted to say, but I'll say it now. I left it out, but here I'm going to say it now. Many people look at the world and there's a lot of negative things happening in the world. No matter what your worldview is, this world has a lot of negativity. And especially in the age of modernity, when negativity can be world sweeping, as we have witnessed in the last over 100 years. So how could we make a difference in God's plan? Well, you just heard it in today's class. It doesn't matter how many of these, well, it does matter that there's so much negativity happening, but you're impacting those people who do not know or care about the Almighty. But if they are involved in the supply chain of anything whatsoever, in any which way, they are being elevated. Their shoes are being elevated. The gasoline in the car is being elevated. All of the equipment that extracted that gasoline and separated it from the crude, and on it goes.